she's really...
senior citizens if nobody else, wouldn't they?
I don't know who the governor has appointed.
They haven't appointed anybody, have they?
Egan appointed Colin McDonald, and he turned it down, and I don't know, nobody seemed to... I don't know if anybody's ever written to him about it.
I'd like to get the agreement between the Pioneer Park Board, just to read the agreement between them and the city.
Yeah.
See. So that has to be renewed. I have a copy of the... I went to the city and I got a copy of that original agreement between the Pioneer Park Board and Alaska Land. They turned the land over to Alaska Land back in 66, I guess. But there have been two or three agreements since then.
Well, I think the renewed it here a couple of years ago. Or
it's got to be renewed every 5 years.
Yeah, it was renewed.
Didn't you have something on that when you were in prison, some of that paperwork?
Yeah, well, it was renewed that next year after I got off the board.
That was 2 years ago.
And, then it had one more year to go before they renewed it, I think, a year in advance. We got it renewed a year in advance.
Were you on the Pioneer Park Board?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was the president of the Pioneer Park Board for a while.
Nobody else wanted it.
That was after Leo Schofield.
Anything I really would like to get on it.
You don't get
too much competition.
Yeah, Leo Schofield went off, and then I went on. And then I was there 2 years, and then Francis Baker went on.
Yeah.
He wanted me to go back on again, but I... Gee, after a couple of years with Clara on that museum thing, I thought, gee, it was kind of, it'd be kind of nice to...
Vacation. Poor Clara.
Well, just one of the unfortunate things.
Here's the time. Get down, Russ. Go get your box now. That's
well, can I just ask you a few questions? I'm just going to tape it so I don't have to take too many notes. This story in the All Alaska Weekly, July 11th. Are there any inaccuracies in that? Did you read that?
Yeah. Did you read it?
So Charlotte Thomas, our Queen Regent, was born Charlotte Lynn in a log cabin on Esther Creek, 10 miles from Fairbanks, February 1st, 1914. Is that correct?
Yeah, the dates are right. I don't know about the log cabin. Bruce says it must have been a log cabin.
Her father, well, Charles Lynn.
I saw some pictures there.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There were pictures of the log house.
You were talking about the picture with my sister.
I didn't quite recognize you because...
Oh, I've changed a little
bit. Yeah, you're only right about that long, but it was in front of a log house with your...
Didn't look like Charlotte?
Not a bit.
And my carnation milk box.
At least you weren't laying out flat on the mattress. You were in a buggy or something. No,
carnation milk box.
The carnation milk box.
He still got that picture.
Oh, yeah, someplace.
Your father, Charles Lynn, he was one of the last... members, charter members of the...
Yeah, he and Bob Bloom were the last two.
Yeah.
He died just before, a couple years before Bob did.
So I remember I wrote, there were three, there was one who lived in California, and then Charles Lynn, and then Bob Bloom.
Yeah. And the one in California, nobody thought anything about until I guess Clara got a letter from him one time. Mm-hmm. I forget what his name was.
Yeah, I've forgotten too. I had a list of them somewhere.
Well, it's on that charter picture that we've got.
Did you have any brothers and sisters, Charlotte?
Half brother and half sister. Mother's children by a former marriage.
Are they still living?
Yeah, they live in Seattle.
What's their names?
Harold Jestland and Mrs. Edith Munson.
Harold Jestland?
J-E-S-T-L-A-N-D.
T-L-A-N-D. And your sister's?
Mrs. Edith Munson, M-O-N-S-E-N.
Okay, you have two sons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they, according to this story, they live in...
I was in California and was back in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn?
Mm-hmm.
That's where Evelyn Melville was born. Did you know that?
No,
I didn't. Oh, I know lots of little tidbits. I did a historical tape on the Forbes paper.
Oh.
And he was telling how he hit her.
Yeah.
really interesting life. You know, his mother was widowed. His brother was Dorman Baker, after whom
Dorman Baker. Mm-hmm.
American Post, American Legion Post, his name. And then she married Roy Ferguson. And Forbes was, 14, 15 years old or something like that. And he said he didn't get along too well with his stepfather. And he got a little older. He just left home, went outside and joined the Army.
Hmm.
He served in the Army and the Navy. He was in the Signal Corps. He was telling me about being transferred from Seattle in the Signal Corps to the Arizona border because they were trying to catch Pancho Villa.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, it's
sakes.
Really interesting. He told about, since they were in the Signal Corps, how the farmers down there, ranchers, used to use the, I think it was the third wire on their, they have telephone or telegraph wires to a certain place, and then they come to a bunch of ranches. They just take the wire, go down and put it, I think it was the third wire, top wire, or about three wires they have around ranches. Anyway, they use that for transmission. They get to the gate, they take the wire up over the gate and around. And he was describing how they, every once in a while, they splice into that to send messages. And the farmers used it for communication, telephone communication.
Huh.
Real old. Anyway, he was telling me that he was in the Navy, left the Signal Corps and went in the Navy, and was back and forth on transports during World War I.
Hmm.
And he met Bertha in Brooklyn when he was hospitalized. And she was not a nurse, but she was a church volunteer and used to come to the hospital all the time. That's how I met her. And then they were married, and Evelyn was born in Brooklyn.
Hmm.
And she came up here when she was just 6 months old.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I didn't realize that.
Quite interesting lives some of these people have had.
Former sister-in-law was married to Roy Ferguson, though.
Former sister-in-law?
He said Dorman, didn't you say Dorman's wife was married to Roy Ferguson?
No,
widow?
Their mother.
Oh, his
Forbes.
Mother. Forbes' mother.
And Dorman's mother was married to Roy Ferguson. With Independent Lumber, isn't that the
mm-hmm.
name of that fellow? Have you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She had been widowed, you know, their father had died, and then she had been widowed. Anyway, back to your son in Brooklyn. Which one is that?
That's the youngest one, Brian.
Brian.
Spelled with an I.
Brian in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And the other one is?
Terry.
Terry.
Lives in Diamond Bar, California.
Diamond Bar.
It's near Claremont.
You got a friend there.
Yeah. Dogs and cats like Jim. You got mosquito dope on or something?
No, a little bit, but.
So you were born on at Esther.
Mm-hmm. On Ready Bullion.
On Ready Bullion Creek. And you said this date was right.
Mm-hmm.
February 1st, 1914. Your mother. How long did your mother live?
She died in 1948.
What was her first name?
Yeah, T-H-E-A.
Did she come into Fairbanks when Fairbanks was just struck?
She came to Dawson first in 1900.
1900.
With her first husband.
And when did they drift over to Fairbanks?
He never did. She came down and went to the Iditarod country before
mm-hmm.
she met Dad. She was cooking for the Strandberg brothers down there.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad. That was the other Strandberg, the older Strandberg.
David
brothers.
Strandberg, yeah.
Did you know any of them, Jim?
Strandberg?
Their father,
yeah.
She knew Charlie, didn't you?
Yeah.
He was the one that lived here for so long.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Dave,
his old father.
Did you know Dave?
Oh, sure. I used to play cribbage with him.
He wasn't here, though, at any time, was he? Except going through?
No, just going through, and then I, McGrath, and when I was in Flat and Good News Bay, I played cribbage with him.
Yeah. I didn't
know him. You know, we used to have contests. Every time we got together, he used to challenge me to a game of cribbage, Dave.
Well, how about your father, Charles Lynn? When did he come into the country?
He came in 1898.
Into Dawson?
Came on the Chilkoot Pass into Dawson.
Did he come by himself or with relatives?
With a brother.
With a brother? I'm asking all these questions because I better write a story about the king and queen regent.
Well, he was caught in that. He was caught in that.
Not the big one, the small slides.
The small slides.
Yeah.
The same year, though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was it right at the same time as the big slide? Right in there?
I don't know.
Don't you have a copy of that diary someplace? I don't know what the date was.
He left the diary outside, but Vera sent me a copy of it one time, but I don't know what it did with it.
I don't remember. I remember reading it, but I don't remember the date. Yeah.
But it was in 98. Yeah. That's when the big slide was, wasn't it?
Yeah, the big slide was 98.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was the same one.
Oh, he said it wasn't. One time he said it wasn't in the big one. It was in the smaller one.
I know he dug his brother out anyway.
But he was here in Fairbanks when the Igloo number 4 pioneers was chartered, because
yeah.
He was one of the few remaining members, I know, 5 or 6 years ago.
He came to Fairbanks the first time in 1902, didn't he?
Yeah, well.
He and Gus Conrad?
Yeah, but he must have come from Nome then.
Well, he hit every strike that was in.
He went from Dawson, he stopped at Morlock Creek, and the stampede at Morlock Creek, and he was on his way to Nome. He was necking a sled to Nome.
Where's Morlock Creek?
Morlock.
Creek.
That's below Rampart. Between Rampart and Tananaw. Because I remember when I was working there, he was telling me that he was there, stopped there at the stampede when he was on his way to Nome.
Oh.
The stampede at Morlock was 1902.
Is it Morlock?
Yeah. M-O-R-E-L-O-C-K.
One word.
L-O-C-K. Morlock. Is that
Mm-hmm.
named after someone, or?
Oh, I imagine so. It'd be easy to look it up in the Mm-hmm. place names, you know.
Have you heard? I haven't heard of it. Of course, there are a lot of places.
It's near Shefflin Creek, which was named after the Shefflin brothers, just above it on the Yukon. Shefflin Creek, then Quartz
Yeah.
Creek, and then Morlock, and then Bear Creek.
And then you went to the Nome Stampede in 1900?
He was necking a sled on his way to Nome. Well, I don't know whether he was on his way back in 1902. I know he told me that he was at the stampede at Morlock, and I know that he necked all his belongings from Dawson to Nome on a sled.
Well, he hit every stampede that there was in the country.
Yeah,
in those early days, I know.
He was, well, except the one at Rampart, because I think that was before Dawson, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was 2 years before. Well,
but he was also on Rampart and Manly
Rampart
Hot Springs.
Rampart was just before the, it was in 96, as I recall, just before the Dawson strike. You got a book on all the strikes,
Bruce? Yeah, someplace. I was just looking for one book. Non-Dalton Village, population 205 on the west shore of Six Mile Lake, 15 miles north of Iliamna, Alaska. Non-Dalton Village. Non-Dalty. Noon-Dalty. Variation.
Changed.
Noon. Nandalty Village. Canadian Indian name recorded on a 1909 field sheet by D.C. Witherspoon, USGS. Nam Dalton Post Office was established in 1938.
I feel better now.
So it really didn't start out as
Non-Dalton. Yeah.
Non-Dalty, Non-Dalton Lake, 6 Mile Lake, Non-Dalton Village. Non-Dalty Lake. in Six Mile Lake. Non-Valnook River. Nunavalduk.
Anyway.
This is really a good publication.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was published by the Geological Survey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They revised the old edition, but it has a lot of an introductory part of it. It's pretty good. I think it's out of print again, the darn thing.
Hmm.
Dictionary of Alaska Coast Names.
They probably don't print too many of them, do they?
What?
I bet they don't print too many.
No, It didn't last very long. I think this is probably the third. Reprinted in 1971
mm-hmm.
with minor revisions. Then they had a printed in 1967, first print. 67, second printing, 71. This is the, well, they call it first printing in 67, but there was one prior to this one.
Mm-hmm.
Was published about 1912 or
13.
Oh, yeah. And I had the first printing in 1967. That's out in the Bureau of Mines office. It's still mine. It's still out there. I should pick it up one day.
Yeah, before.
And then I got this. This printing was given, was a gift to me. The other one I bought, and this one was given to me. This is a 71 printing.
Well, to get back to you, Charlotte, you were born and ready in Reading-William Creek. Did you live out there then for a good many years? Or
about
did you
a year and a half when we went to Livengood.
And then how long did you live in Livengood?
My dad might out there off and on. We moved to town in 1920.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went back, I guess, in the mines there until...
Went to Manioxford.
That was 28, wasn't it? 27 or
28. Then
in
1927 or 28
he
went to
Manioxford. He was there, Mike Hansen.
Oh,
Bob Hansen's family.
Young wood chopper.
Yeah, he knows more about what he did than I did.
He was on a wood chopper than he was with.
Yeah, I talked to Siegfried Hansen. They call him Fred Hansen?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I talked to him in Anchorage and got a historical tape from him. He's quite a nice...
He's a nice little guy.
Nice little guy, yeah.
I saw him at Palmer. I hadn't seen him, gee, I don't know for how many years. Quite a few.
Most people call him Fred Hansen. And so, did he mine over there in Woodchopper area then for the rest of his years, or?
No, he was only there about a year or so.
Yeah.
And then he went to work at for the FE company. He was a rigger on the during the construction of the dredges. And after that, he went to work for the railroad.
Oh, he worked for Cap Lathrop for a while down at the coal mine, too.
When did he do that? I've forgotten that.
That was before he went with the railroad. He was down there with Cap Lathrop for a while. Not too long, but he was.
It hadn't been too long. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, he did.
What did he do on the railroad? Conductor? Or?
No, he was a car repairman.
So when he was mining then in Woodchopper and working on the dredges, did you live here in town and go to school? Or did you go out, did the family go with you?
We were at Manly Hot Springs. But when he was working on the dredges, he drove back and forth to town.
Mm-hmm. When you lived in Fairbanks, did you live in this vicinity on 5th?
No, we lived in the corner of 3rd and Wickersham.
3rd and Wickersham?
Mm-hmm. Torn down now, that's where the B&W parking lot is.
Oh, yeah. Right next to Rosamond
mm-hmm.
Willers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you went to call your schooling here in Fairbanks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Graduated from the Red School House.
The Red School House. And you went to the University of Alaska, too. And did you, it was what, was it called the university then?
No, or? Alaska Agricultural College. Mm-hmm.
And did you graduate?
34. Didn't change until the next year. After father graduated. After they got rid of father, they changed to the University of Alaska.
Yeah, got rid of me.
I think lots of things happened around about 1935 up there. As I recall. Is that when you went out there, Jim?
No, 37.
37?
I don't know, 1 year.
I've been telling lies about you. I thought you went out there in 1935.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
They were nice lies anyway, but if that's what they were.
Maybe it enhanced the history of the school a little bit. Well, when you graduated from the agricultural college, then did you teach? Or
1 year.
You taught 1 year?
Uh-huh.
And then you were married? Mm-hmm. That ended your teaching career?
That ended my teaching career. They didn't want me no more.
They didn't want Mary Lou?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Sure different now.
No, now they'll take anything they can get.
You know.
As long as they breathe.
I know, just the when I was teaching, because we had married teachers when I was going to school, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, they had a rule in when that year I taught that you couldn't be married and teach. So I didn't like it very much anyway. That was all right.
Well, what is your position at the Pioneer Home? Are you an
administrative assistant?
Administrative assistant to the director.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been out there now quite a few years.
8 years.
8 years.
Since it opened.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Mm-hmm. It opened in July of 67, as I recall.
Right.
Just before the flood.
This got all nicely settled in, and along came the waters.
Yeah. 67,
Burgess
built that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't have too much damage, though, during the flood,
no.
As I recall. I didn't go out there during the flood, but as I recall talking to, I think Jack Link said there were maybe 5 or 6 inches of water, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there wasn't too much. It didn't last too long. Where, of course, where it was bad was all the basement was full, and that's where all the heating system was.
Yeah.
Everything down there was full of mud and silt and everything.
Yeah.
But as far as the building was itself, it just took a lot of cleaning up, was all.
When the Pioneer Home opened, they had room for how many guests?
63.
You got, what, 3 times that number?
119.
63. 119. So that's just doubled almost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are the most of the beds filled now, right there?
Let's see, the last count we had were 85 people here right now.
Is this working at the Pioneer Home? Is it the first time you worked since you taught school, or had you worked?
Oh, I worked in the school district for a while. I worked in the central office.
Mm-hmm.
It was down in the old main school, and then when they moved out on Airport Way.
Did you work for Jack Link when he was the comptroller or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's the reason I went down to Pioneer Home, because when he got that job, he asked me if I'd like to come back and work for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was fun. He was a real nice person to work for.
Yeah. She had a lot of rapport with the people there.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, he knew all of them.
Yeah.
They too knew the difference.
Just like an extended Pioneer meeting almost.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
He's always so, I don't know, just so solicitous.
Really nice person.
Well, Bruce, what about you? I understand you were born in Treadwell.
Right.
In the mine?
Yeah,
no.
They fished him out of a hole.
No, I was born in one of the company houses there. At Treadwell.
And when were you born?
January 1st, 1913.
J. January 1st is Forbes Baker's birthday, too. Mm-hmm. Iris Garland's birthday, too.
Oh, yeah.
I think they were celebrating Iris' birthday and New Year's.
I had a sister that was born... my sister was born Christmas Day the year before, 1912. She died several years ago, but she was born Christmas.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I have two brothers.
Sure you do, you have two brothers.
Robert L. and Merle F. Jr.
No Jr. no more,
but then...
And your mother is Agnes. She's
Agnes, yeah, Agnes Catherine Kimmerly, her name was.
Is that K-A-T-H or C-A?
K.
Catherine.
Kimmerling.
K-I-M-E-R.
K-E-M-M-E-R-L-I-N-G.
K-E-M-M-E-R-L-I-N-G.
Yeah, her father came up, I don't know, it was before 98, to work at Treadwell in the... Michigan, and she came up when she was a young girl. What was it, 19?
Did she come up about that time too?
No. Her family came later. What, she'd come in 19-2, was it?
I think that's what we figured out, that she didn't.
Try to figure something like that. But she was a young girl. Oh, there were several in her family.
So you had two brothers and one sister.
Yeah, my sister died years ago.
Mm-hmm. So you, the Treadwell mine was on Douglas Island.
Right.
And was there a town of Douglas at the time, or did they just call it?
Oh no, there was a town of Douglas, but I was born at the mine at Treadwell.
And how far from where Douglas?
Well,
is
it
right
joins
now.
Douglas.
Well, the Treadwell is all underground.
Well, it was an underground mine, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they had an old glory hole. The house I was born in was the first one that went down the glory hole after the cave-in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Felix Gray gave me a copy of a map with a circle on it, and I've got it back there. He says that was the house I was born in. It was the first one that went down the glory hole when the cave-in.
Well, what do you mean by glory hole?
Well, I had an open... Well, something like an open pit. Only thing is that all the ore went down underground and was hoisted back up again, but it was open. They blasted the ore into a shaft. Well, it was a chute, and then they hoisted it up from underground. And when the mine caved in, this filled with water, and it, well, the water cascaded out over the top, and it washed it.
Oh, I see.
Is that what they call the glory hole?
Yeah, it's pretty well caved in now.
Is it possible to see where it is? If you're
sure. Oh, yeah, it's still there. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, you can see it. The glory hole's still there. It's full of fish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's still there.
It's full of water, then.
Yeah, it's full of water, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When it caved in, the mine had flooded.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And it filled the mine...
Full of water.
Full of water, mm-hmm. So that eroded the ground and the...
Yeah, right.
Well, Treadwell, was that just a mining camp? Where you were born, was it just like Effie Camp out at Esther?
Well, yeah, and they had some company houses and warehousing, mills, and all the surface plant.
What was your father's name?
Merle F. Thomas.
Okay.
His father was there too.
M-E-R-L.
Same with Merle Jr.?
Mm-hmm.
M-E-R-L or?
M-E-R-L. My sister's name was M-E-R-E-L.
Merle.
I mean, that was just a...
Mm-hmm. I never had a girl, I thought I was going to call her Merle. I thought that was such a pretty name.
It is pretty. How about your father? When did he die?
He died in 66.
66.
March of 66.
You used to live down there. Your mother and father lived down there. What was it, 7th?
7th, right? Yeah, 7th
and Barnett.
Fire station. Mm-hmm. Fire 7th
and Barnett.
Mm-hmm.
It sits there down there on 2nd and State Street or something, now, doesn't it?
Did somebody in the family still own it?
No, it was sold at auction. Somebody else got it.
Urban Renewal took it home.
Drain in Urban Renewal.
Yeah, I remember. Well, they're sure putting a lot of state monuments up in that area.
Are they?
Well, the parking garage.
Oh, yeah.
State building and,
yeah.
Spending money like it's going out of style. Well, your two brothers live here in Fairbanks.
Right.
And they're, are they partners in the, what do you call it?
Builder Services.
Okay.
All three of us. All three of us are partners. Yeah.
You two?
Oh, yeah.
But you're retired now from Bureau of Mines. But you just came back from the Cantician. What were you doing out there? You're not going to tell anybody?
No, I was just down there with Weisland and Butler. They have some property down there, and I just went down to, and the trip to give him a hand was all.
How about Pilgrim? Is he still there?
He's in Stampede, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's still there.
You said you saw him the other day, didn't you?
I saw him in town here, about 10 days ago, or maybe a little bit more than that.
Yeah. Does he stay out there all winter?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh, does he?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
His nephew flew up from Seattle and in his own airplane, he brought Earl into town, and then Earl was here for a couple of days and went back.
Gee, it'd be a lonesome life.
When you were out there with Butch Butler and Earl Weisland, did you see or hear of any Park Service people going around in helicopters checking mining claims for monuments and markers?
Russell Chadwick.
Chadwick?
I heard was, yeah. He was with Bear Creek. Over in the Kobuk, huh?
Well, that one.
Yeah, that Chadwick, yeah. I understand he has a contract with the Park Service to evaluate the mining claims in the Cantician or something like this. I didn't see him, but one of the miners told me that he was there.
Well, some of the miners are a little disturbed that they're going in, and what they're doing is making a gross mineral assessment for the Park Service. So when they settle these D2 lands and Park Service lands, and they can say, well, there may be some mining claims on record, and they're going out to check the monuments and the markers on mining claims to see if they're really validly marked. And some of the miners are kind of concerned because they've had claims out there for years, and maybe a stream washes out a corner or something, or a stake. So they're a little up in arms, some of them. Have you heard anything on that?
No, but I heard that Chadwick had approached one of the fellows down there as to how much he wanted for his holdings in the Cantician. Mm-hmm. Apparently he's trying to get some sort of an idea of what value people have put on what they hold there. Apparently, this is all there.
Well, I have a copy of the invitation to bid that the Park Service put out. And it's for that Cantician, the extension of McKinley Park, Iliamna, and one other area.
Copy of the bid for a consultant?
Mm-hmm. For this gross mineral, they call it a gross mineral assessment. But I've had a couple people I've had more than that come into Senator Stevens' office and Fussner and fuming and concerned because they have mining claims and they are afraid Park Service is going to go in and take them in and or claim that they had not done assessment work and were not there. A lot of the land isn't patented.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was more is unpatented than patented, I would think. I would say just offhand.
Yeah.
Most of the patented claims are on Quigley Ridge there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to talk to Earl on that because the 18th of December this year, the regional corporations have to have their land selections in.
Right.
And the village corporations had to have their land selections in last December. And then there's another step where the Park Service is going to get into the act, and
that's on the detour.
U.S. Forest Service is going to get into the act, and the National Park, you know, McKinley and Wild and Scenic Rivers and the whole schmear.
Yeah. Bureau of Outdoor Recreation, I guess it is, BOR, gets into the act, which is separate from the Park Service.
Yeah.
Bureau of Outdoor Recreation, the Park Service, Fish and Wildlife, and the Forest Service. I think that D2 land business, what is happening, I think the... these D2 lands and the approach that the Congress has taken towards land in Alaska. The sovereign state of Alaska is going to amount to a pinch of beans because it's going to be subservient to... They're letting itself, so far as I see the picture developing, the state is letting itself become subservient to the oil industry, and then it's going to be subservient to big federal bureaucracy, because they're going to hold a substantial part of the lands in the state.
Yeah.
And I think this is a shame.
No doubt about it.
And I think that the the Congress should have made provision that the state of Alaska should have a weighted decision process in what the federal government would do with the lands in Alaska. Otherwise, why have a state?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were given $103 million, wasn't it?
This is true, but we still don't have it all selected. This is true, and I think that the federal government should, and the Congress particularly, should consult more with the state as to what they want the federal government to do with its lands within the state, not Massachusetts or Texas or Vermont or Rhode Island or California, New Mexico, or Arizona. I think that otherwise the state loses its sovereignty. Why have a state? Why not go right back to the territory bit again?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what has disturbed me was that Egan was reticent to stand up and be counted, and Hammond is doing no better. And
I don't understand the status of that law. The states sued against the federal government on certain lands that they had selected.
Well,
feds came in and, you know, supersede any state selections.
Yeah. Well, apparently they had an agreement with Interior, Department of Interior, and then Interior just ignored it. And then they were going to have this lawsuit, and I don't know what happened.
Well, you know, the new Secretary of Interior, Hathaway, have you read about him or heard about him?
Well, I've read a little bit about him.
He's going to be here in August for about 10 or 12 days in the state. He'll be here in Fairbanks. I don't know what dates. But I think it's a good chance for Alaskans to bend his ear.
Well, I think...
Because he's a reasonable man. He came from Wyoming, and he has a good... He's not a... He has a reasonable reputation, in other words. He's not an environmentalist or preservationist or an exploiter for the sake of exploiting. He's got a good record.
I think our congressional delegation should be highly sensitive to the sovereign rights of the state. This trading off for a few federal bucks for the current state, I think they can forego that and stand up and be counted. I'm disappointed. My gosh, I think they... I don't know what they can do, but they should be highly jealous of the sovereign rights of the state of Alaska, and this is what they're for.
That's why I'm asking you about
and
this.
And they're drifting along with... They're going about it the easy way.
That's why I was asking, when you're out there in the Kantishna, if you ran across this, because the Forest Service does these things, and I found out about it. And then I told Senator Stevens, and he didn't even know about it. He wrote a hot letter to the head of the Park Service and asked him what the hell was going on in Alaska. Because these guys were going around and touching down and, marking on their map what looked like a valid monument and what wasn't. Nobody even knew that they...
Well, to back up a little bit, wasn't the thing settled in the Statehood Act or the Organic Act established in the state? Didn't it say, isn't there language that how much land is federal land, how much is state, or is it...
Well, the enabling yeah, legislation is quite explicit in stating how many acres the state will get. But what I'm saying is that the rest of the land belongs to the federal government, but the state itself should have some weighted decision making in the decision, some something weighted in the decision making process to have a strong voice in what the federal government is going to do with their lands, whether it be open public domain, whether it be a park, a fish pool, or a swimming pool, or anything of this nature. Most of these people sitting on these boards are just like that article that appeared in the Fairbanks paper, this little town in Washington, where the Forest Service was moving in and they said, we don't want them. The guy says, well, I represent 200 million people. Yeah, he represents 200 million people, but how many of those 200 million people are in favor of taking away the rights that those people have in that little town in Washington? You know? The same way what's her name, Cecilia Hunter, sitting on that commission, says, I represent 200 million people. She represents 200 million people, but how many of those 200 million people are even aware of what she stands for? Do they support her, you see? I think this sort of warps, gives you a warped concept of...
Sure does,
And
did you read here in late June where the Bureau of Land Management is seeking nominations for a land use advisory board for BLM? Did any of the miners put in any suggestions for that?
Not that I know of.
I talked to Bill Wagaman a few days ago, and he said that the Alaska miners suggested a couple names.
Did they?
Here. Yeah. So I talked to Ledesky Saturday. These homesteaders up there near Tanana started that big fire up there. One of the guys had a burn pile that started it. That's where it started. And they were all in a sweat because it was out of control, and the BLM wouldn't send guys in there and let them burn themselves to death, you know, saving a cabin or two. And so I was calling Ledesky on that. And so while I had him on the phone, I asked him about that, if there was... because I was interested in it. And I asked him if there was quite a lot of input on it. He says, well, they've gotten some nominations. And I said, well, I'm really interested in that. I'd like to get my name in there. And because I'm afraid that there are going to be umpteen preservationists and conservationists. He says, you can bet there are. They suggested lots of people. He said, if you're really interested, get your name in. So I did the next day. And I called Kurt McVee in Anchorage, who's the head BLM man, told him I was interested. So he told me to write out a... Hey, these things go on and nobody does anything about it. And I asked somebody at the Chamber of Commerce if they had received anything on it. And they had, but they, you know, they have 10,000 other things that they get requested to do, and they didn't do anything on it. And the borough got some kind of thing on it, but they didn't act on it. But the Environmental Center, they get something like that, and they just go to town.
They jump on it.
So you just have to be... I asked Senator Stevens if he minded if I put my name in there, if there'd be any conflict. He said, no, go ahead, they'll pick you, go ahead. Because there's got to be somebody who can represent, you know, all of Alaska, and not just the miners, and not just the Celia Hunters. But have a little more well-rounded approach, and who understands what this Native Land Settlement Act, that's a far-reaching thing. And you, what you said about Egan is true, the same thing about Hammond. Neither one is aggressively going after what we as Alaskans should be fighting for.
And saying, jealous of the sovereign rights of the state, you know, even if they're overruled, for goodness sakes,
tell me this,
pound the table, you know.
You've been a member of the Pioneers and officer and trustee and various and sundry things. Do you think that the Pioneers here or the state, the Grand Igloo, would be interested in meeting with Hathaway, a few of them, talking about some of the inherited rights of pioneers like you and Charlotte and Jim? You know, I'm a Chief Jackal.
So. I would say so. I don't think there'd be any...
Who would be the one of the pioneers to talk to on that? Because I don't know who's setting up Hathaway... Well, I know who's setting up Hathaway's schedule. Mm-hmm. And I just think people like that ought to talk to him.
Well, I think, I'm pretty sure that Earl Beislein would, you know, would like to. And
I mean, representing the pioneer, the pioneer stock here in Alaska.
Yeah.
Now, Earl is really good, and he's articulate.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
can really...
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But... I'm not talking about Bill Schaefer, who wouldn't understand.
No. Well, I think Bob Hoffman
would be real.
Yeah,
Hoffman is really good on his feet.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He would be good.
But I guess I might be out of line suggesting that.
Cashin might be. Cashin has a propensity to exaggerate. The establishment of a lot of setting aside a lot of land for park purposes and this sort of thing, but he should be there anyway. I mean, after all,
maybe I'll talk to a few of them and
see.
Bob Huffman's he's a trustee for the Grand Igloo, I think.
No, he's a grand historian.
No, he's a grand something.
Yeah, historian, grand historian.
He was a chaplain last year, wasn't he?
Yeah. The grand historian.
And then Don Herring was the trustee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Don was the trustee.
You know, has he been replaced?
Yeah.
Well, he wouldn't be replaced until the
meeting
in October.
Yeah. Yeah, he'd be replaced.
But he was a grand trustee.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe I'll talk to Bob Huffman.
Clyde Garrity and Carl Erickson.
Mm-hmm.
He's
that's a good suggestion.
Yeah, you know.
Now there's some of the past grands and past grand officers who just wouldn't understand what we're talking about, like Adolf Stock. Wouldn't understand it. Wouldn't be interested in it. But I just think it'd be kind of neat to have some of the pioneers of Alaska represented in. You know, send two or three people to some kind of meeting as delegates from the pioneer. This, you know, Alaska Stock.
Mm-hmm.
Beislein and Huffman would be real good because they're both.
I don't think Alaska Lake would be bashful either.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea.
You know.
Sure.
We'll see. It's none of my business, and I shouldn't be promoting that, probably. But I know who's setting up Hathaway's schedule, and I think. He has a good reputation, and Senator Stevens was tickled to death to see him get the nomination, I'll tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of preservationists who were writing letters against him.
Jeez, we got enough of those things.
But Alaskans are glad, who know Hathaway's record, they're glad to see that he got it and not...
I'll tell you what they could do. They could go before him and say... We're an endangered species. We're going to have help.
The interior under Udall
mm-hmm.
put out a beautiful illustrated publication on Are We the Endangered Species?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did you see that? Did you ever see that? Well, it's a fantastic thing.
Is on the telephone. Tell me what you're going to wear for Golden Days. What kind of a... Are you going to wear an authentic old dress?
No, I don't have one.
Oh,
yeah.
Did
you?
Oh, boy.
I wish I had one.
Oh, good.
The one I'm making, wherever you have made, will be a wonder.
You're making it yourself? You have a pattern?
Yeah, it looks sort of old-time.
Yeah, well, fine. I'm glad you called, Earl. Good. Have a good flight.
Are you going to, do you have anything that you're wearing that really is antique or hand-me-down from relatives?
Give my regards to everybody that I know.
During the war, Mother had a lot of old things. She had one real good-looking cream-colored suit, and I remember seeing it up in the cupboard, for years and years. And during the war, she had so many relatives.
Yeah.
in Norway that didn't have her. Gee, she's cleaned everything out. Of course,
yeah.
Just cleaned everything out and sent it to me. So there was nothing left of her.
I'd like to get an old 1900 dress, even if I had to buy it from somebody outside just to wear it Golden Days time. What are you going to wear at Golden Days time? A derby?
Derby and a vest?
That's going to be the extent of his costume.
Where's your beard? I thought all King Regents had beards.
Oh, well, I'll have to
why
use the...
Well,
I'll have
beard.
To use the beard of the little man from Little El Dorado.
I don't know about that one.
Oh, well, if they had... Weren't you an installation?
Oh, yeah.
The little man
from... Oh, how could I forget that? Oh, Jim, you should have seen that.
He's still got his head sitting in there.
I still got his head in the bedroom.
I got
there.
Some pictures made of that, didn't I?
I think you did.
Yeah.
Little Pat Lloyd.
Gee, Hoffman and I made that and we laughed.
Tell Jim about that. He wasn't there. God, that was funny.
Well,
it was Beislein's
tent. Beislein has a tent, had a tent up there in Little El Dorado. And he was always bugging Hoffman about putting some electric power in there from GVEA, you know, and all this sort of stuff. So Bob and I got together and decided that, well, and I just don't know how it came about, but between the two of us,
Hoffman had a trap line up there, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a trap line. He used to stop by there and knock the snow off the tent and all this sort of stuff, so... Anyway, we cooked up a story that there's been somebody had moved in Earl's tent, moved in this tent. And then we decided, well, if somebody moved in it, we better
get somebody in there.
So I get this. That was your head, wasn't it? I took
wig head.
Her wig head, and we painted it up and put a beard on it and put a fur hat on it, and then we stuffed some coveralls, and Bob Huffman's kids helped that, and I went up to Bob's house and we made this guy in coveralls, put gloves on him and the whole bit. And Bob goes up there. We had a prearranged a trip where
Beislein was supposed to go up and check it out.
Beislein and Dan Egan and myself, which when we used to go up there periodically in the wintertime, you know, just to, on a snow machine. We got together with Dan and told him that on a certain day, on a certain Sunday, Earl should have to be up there. Well, then Hoffman took the little man from Little El Dorado up and put him in the tent. He was just ahead of us. It was all timed, and he'd gone ahead of us, and Earl didn't even know what was going on. Takes the guy up and he puts him in this tent, and it's kind of, it was one of these GI type things. It was kind of dark. We lit a candle, had a bottle of beer on the table, and this little guy sitting in there, you know, in the tent. So we drive up there, and here's all his footprints going over there, and a little wood pile out in front, and all this stuff, and Earl thought, well, somebody really had moved into his bloody tent, you know. And he walks over there, and I'm right behind him, and Dad's behind him, and he opened up this door, and his mouth opened about a foot. You know, you see this guy sitting there with a candlelight, you know, and his bottle of beer there in his hand. And then he took a second look at him. He didn't say anything at first. Then after he took a second look at him, then he let out a heck of a big shriek. And by that time, Hoffman and everybody else that was with him come down there. Oh, gosh, we had a lot of fun. But
so when installation was time was out at El Dorado Creek.
When though? When?
Oh, winter before last.
And Hoffman and Beislein took it down to installation when Bruce was going to be installed as the president of the igloo.
And after Bruce, Bruce gave his acceptance or something, they had another person who wanted to speak or something.
It was a man from Little El Dorado.
Bob said you did a good job on a bottle of booze building that.
Yeah, we had a drink or two. Yeah, we had a lot of fun.
Well, I don't know anybody has more fun than Pioneers, that's for sure. Are you going to be here for Golden Days, Jim?
Yeah, I think so.
It'll be...
That's only another week.
A week from... tomorrow's Thursday.
Yeah, I should be here.
Thursday, Friday, and Saturday is when most of the activities are. Well, Bruce and Charlotte are the king and queen regent.
Yes,
you know that.
I know.
And they're going to be honored at the regent's tea. I went to the newcomers club today and spoke with Sonny Carpenter and Laura Bear. About 80 women there. So I invited them to come to that. Well, it was, you know, honoring the king and queen regent, and both of you had lived here all your lives, and real Alaskans, and there'd be a fashion show, so, you know, to honor the king and queen regent, but there'd be refreshments and a fashion show of real authentic old garments. So I had some fun.
Well, you know, last year when I had it down the outside, it was just literally packed. That was two packs.
Where was it going to be this time?
Travelers Inn.
Oh.
The gold room. They had the whole gold room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's costly. You know, it cost about $700 to rent that place.
Wow.
But they decided they were going to do it so they'd have plenty of room.
Yeah.
So many out-of-staters who used to live here, you know, former Alaskans come out the golden days.
Yeah, last year there were a lot of people came out. But you can't see anybody, and it was warm. You didn't want to sit there any longer than you had to, you know. Yet the tea was beautiful, and the fashion show and stuff, but it was just so packed.
That was the first golden days I missed for a long time.
Yeah.
Jim and I were floating down the river.
That's right.
That's right.
I hated to miss golden days. I wanted to go in August, but he couldn't get away from Barrow in August, because that's when it...
Well, you went to Skagway and up to White Horse and then down the river. Would you come down and do a raft?
I tried to climb the pass.
Yeah, Mike went over the pass and I met him at Lake Mennett.
Well,
she
and
Nancy Mendenhall and
the court. You know, Don Cook,
walked
his
over.
Wife, and Nancy Mendenhall.
And I met him at Lake Mennett.
And then they got on the train and went back to White Horse.
Then we put us all the way down and Lake. I'd never been to Dawson before.
I went down Lake Bennett and Tagish Lake and down to White Horse and ended up at Eagle.
I didn't believe it then, but they Mike went all the way to...
Were you in a regular tour?
Oh, yeah,
tour,
All those places I read
about.
The
average age was about 15.
You read about in all these books. It was really...
Really?
Yeah.
The clientele. Mostly kids.
Yeah, we went with a group. Because we don't have our own tents.
We've got gear.
Pretty well run.
Yeah, it's starting to look at that around.
When you climb the Chilkoot, you need a tent. You need something that's light. We didn't have to worry about food or tents or anything like that. Just
how long did it take you to go? When
we took 4 days. About 3.5 days.
Over the Chilkoot?
We left Tuesday.
Yeah, we floated down the river for about 10 days, didn't we?
Yeah.
2 weeks, I guess.
Well, we motored part of the way.
Lake LaBarge,
you know, that's a big lake. Holy smokes.
Well, what they have is these rubber rafts, you know, inflated.
I've never seen any of those places.
That was a nice trip. You know, it was something I'd always wanted to do, and I got onto this thing. Mark Egan and Pat Sather and Mary Cook did that the year before, in 73, but they terminated the river trip in Dawson, and I was in Dawson for the 75th anniversary of the Trail of 98, you know, the Stampede. A lot of Fairbanksons over there, even the senior citizens chartered a couple of planes from Fort Yukon Air Service and flew over that Sunday, but there were four of us who drove over, and they came floating down the river, and that's just something I'd really like to do, so I investigated it. I started training for it, and Cora just said, gee, that sounds like fun, maybe I ought to go. She talked to Nancy, and Nancy says, yeah, I think we ought to do that. We were just half-heartedly talking about it, and we started walking up and down Esther Dome to get in shape. And pretty soon after we were doing it really in earnest, maybe we ought to have some second thoughts on this. But they ended up going. We didn't have any trouble going over the trail. It's tough in spots. But it was paced out. The days were split up.
No, I see.
We left on a Tuesday afternoon and hiked to, we went to Canyon City first night. Spent first night at Canyon City. And then the next night at sheep camp, just below the steep part. The third day was a tough day because we had to not only climb the real steep part, but when you get into British Columbia, it's not steep, it just goes gradually down, and it takes about 8 miles before you get to tree line. So we had to get to tree line because we didn't have enough fuel to cook with, because there's no fuel. You know, it's just all rock and soggy muskeg and snow at that time. And gravel. No, you have to walk to tree line to get to camp. So it was a 13-mile
hike. Was there a camp, just a grounder or a cabin there where you had to walk a 9 mile? Did you come to a camp?
No, we just camped out.
Oh, yeah.
Pitched our tents. It was on Lake Lindeman. Headed like... No, it was Deep Lake, which runs into Lindeman. Deep Lake is the first real lake. And then Lindeman, it flows into Lindeman. It's really a nice trip. I'd like to do it again someday.
Oh, is there a tour group that takes
that? There's a fellow in Skagway, Skip Burns. He calls his outfit Klondike Safaris. Oh. And he'll guide you over if you need a guide, or if you just, you know, if you just want to walk and have somebody pack all your gear, you know, furnish, whatever. But we went as a group and we carried our own backpacks and all our own gear and some of the food. And he had, I think, four of his crew along, carried a lot of the heavy stuff. You know, young 18, 19-year-old boys who were really strong. And then he came up by train with the float boats, these inflatable things that similar to the ones that go down the Colorado River and run the rapids. But they're made in France, and they're air inflated, of course. Can't tip them over. I felt real secure in them, didn't you, Jim?
Yeah.
We were out in the middle of the Yukon going through Five Finger Rapids and every place. I just felt really secure in it. And you can't sink them because... Unless somebody just took a machine gun and shot every clear down the side, because there's compartmentized. So if the front runs into a sleeper or something, a sharp rock or something, and it's punctured in one spot, maybe that one section will deflate, but the rest won't. And you just paddle over and patch it and pump it back full of air. We didn't have any. I don't think we had one puncture. We had how many? Four rafts?
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty heavily loaded.
Sounds very interesting.
But just before I went on that trip, I was reading a clipping from a